Anthony Huete is an entrepreneurial architect, developer, teacher and researcher who spent the last 30 years in Europe, mostly in the UK. In 2002, he set up What Architecture and then later his own development company called Game of Architecture. Anthony Huete developed a reputation as an award-winning and unconventional architect with a passion for affordable housing. But after spending half his lifetime living in London, his Turanga Waewae has called him home. He returned to Aotearoa, New Zealand to take up the role of Professor of Architecture at the University of Auckland, bringing with him his skills and vision. And now he's turning his attention to Māori and Indigenous architectural projects and finding practical, affordable and sustainable housing solutions. Dr. Anthony Huete is with us. Tēnā koe. Thanks very much for your time.
Kia ora. Mōrena tātou.
Lovely to have you with us. Recently returned to New Zealand, as we said, after establishing yourself as an award-winning architect in the UK, and affordable housing was a particular focus. Could you explain more?
Well, London, much like Auckland, is going through a crisis of affordability, and that has led the architect to often receiving commissions where the fees are low and the quality of work is poor. So I guess at some point, after the global financial crash, I had to look at a more sustainable way of practice, and we decided that the only way to intervene, particularly in the affordability equation, was to have a more expanded type of practice, and therefore intervene in development. And so that means the architect playing the property developer. Now, I had already returned to Aotearoa, New Zealand, in around about 1996, having completed a master's at the Bartlett under Peter Cook, and had come back to build a house for my father on Mōtiti Island. That's our whenua out in the Bay of Plenty. And so I'd already started at that point to play in a more expanded role of practice by being a builder. So I guess, you know, by the time I got back to London and got into practice, I probably already had a kind of an innate DIY sensibility about me, and I basically thought, well, let's give it a shot. It's very risky, but of course, being a developer gives you greater control over what you can do. And so it was fairly obvious to me that the thing I should be doing is affordable housing, so not the bling-bling designer house, but the affordable housing, which means housing of a larger scale, higher densities, and it's detailed slightly different from maybe luxury housing that is attributed to individual house.
Being architect and developer, should that be a more common model in New Zealand? We often have issues with complex chains that can break down, but also, do you simply have a different approach when you are filling both roles?
Yeah, so the approach, so first of all, there is a legacy of the architect developer. It's just that most architecture schools, including Auckland, don't prioritise the teaching of entrepreneurship or money, as we say. You know, it's often values of architecture can often be assigned to cultural, ecologic, but we seem to sidestep learning about the pragmatics of money, and yet architectural practice by nature is a game of survival. So there is a legacy, there is a whakapapa in New Zealand of the architect developer, and there's also some in the United Kingdom. I think the one of the particular respect for is Armin Klarhauer, who I believe came out to New Zealand a few years ago, and he built his own six or seven-storey development, also out of CLT in Clerkenwell, stone building. And so I kind of realised that actually that's the more, you can either have a larger practice and have a sort of larger scale work, or you can have a larger role by playing the developer and therefore have a larger stake in the project. And I guess because of not having some old school network in the United Kingdom, I decided on the second path, which is basically to a more expanded form of practice. And it's risky. It's totally risky because the first property I bought happened because I met a client who asked me, he'd seen a project we'd done called the Rooftop Nursery. That was a the nursery, the objective of getting mothers back into work. And in order to get young mothers back into work, we had to make a building which was cheap. I knew from a New Zealand heritage that cheap building is a painted concrete block. I lived at a Motiti Island, in fact, where my father has built more buildings than myself, and often they are just these simple concrete, painted concrete block methodologies. So we did this nursery. It got some notoriety. It won the RABA, that's Royal Institute of British Architects, National Award for Education. Clients seen it, had heard that we had found the site and put the funding together. I'd also realised that if it was funded by the state, but if the state gave the money to the nursery or the school, then they wouldn't be able to recover the VAT. So then I convinced the local education authority to give our practice, Watt Architecture, the funds. And so from that first stage, that was back in 2007, I was always really looking for sort of ways to maximise budgets and get more value out of the building. So this client had seen it, loved it, and asked me if I could find them a site to build a house. And then I sort of said to him, well, why bother going to all the effort to find a site for an individual dwelling? Why don't we pull resources and set up a development company? So we set up my first development company, which was called Watt Developments, pretty straightforward. My partner, who was Sikh, came from a retail background. The Sikh part is interesting because it was marrying two different cultural systems, Māori and Sikh. Sometimes he would see his numerologist about which days we should make certain transactions. And I was trying to offset that with the te ao Māori, but yeah. Somehow it all kind of crazily worked. And we bought Shoreditch Station, which is about 10 minutes walk from Liverpool Street Station. Now, I'm Māori. I went to school in Kōrero College. You know, there's no way I was being funded by the whānau back home. And so, you know, how to get the money was literally remortgaging. It was probably at a time, it was just after GFC, so there was still pressure on sub-mortgages and the risk around equity and borrowing, et cetera, et cetera. But we made it happen, bought it at an auction, and I tend to use, Catherine, I tend to use auctions, so I was quite reassured when I got back to New Zealand. Why do we use auctions? Because in Britain there's these two beautiful words called gazumping and gazering, and that is... that is either the vendor pulling out of a deal at the last minute to try to motivate a higher price, or the purchaser pulling out at the last moment to try to get the price to drop. And those kind of malpractices were rampant within the real estate market. And so sort of research I was underdoing by this time, I sort of realised that the real estate industry was under-regulated. And having also bid on properties through closed tender, I once bid on a project in a site in Hackney, a fantastic site next to a railway station, and we were told just to email through your best prices. So I put in two bids, one using a sort of fake company, ABC Limited, let's say, and they rang me back and told me that our higher bid was the lower bid. And so it kind of dawned on me that they couldn't really rely on any kind of transparency in that system. So go to an auction. So you're probably, New Zealand's well versed in buying through auctions. It's transparent. I mean, unless the floor is stacked, but generally you can see what's happening on the auction floor. And the other great thing is the banks will accept the valuation on the spot because it's seen as the market reflection. So we bought Shoreditch Station in a hotel room in central London, carrying cash, unbelievably, in a briefcase, with a very large Nigerian bouncer with us, and
it was done. I think you lost the auction, but the winner didn't have the banker's check,
that's
and
right.
There were you with your cash. Well, there's a lovely story attached to Shoreditch as well, because of course cash flow is everything. Boy, is it everything in development. I mean, it's one of the reasons we've got a crisis at the moment. It's one of the reasons we're seeing these businesses falling over at the moment, is all the delays in supply of materials is just blowing out costs, and then on and on it goes. Cash flow matters. But you had an innovative way of ensuring some cash flow once you'd acquired Shoreditch.
Oh, that's right. So, Catherine, well done for your homework. Absolutely. We some hairdressers, unbelievably, beat us, but they couldn't front up with the cash. Anyway, so we had suddenly got this building. We had 30 days to close on it. I started by this time building a relationship with a company called Close Brothers. They're venture capitalists based in London. So you start to build relationships as an architect in different ways with financiers. They then gave us the bridging finance, which was running at something like 7%, so it's still, or 7 or 8%, so it's still quite steep. So I realised that it's going to take some time to get the planning through. So we started to, Shoreditch Station is literally just off Brick Lane. For those listeners who know London, it was the epicentre of trend in the round about 2010. So we started off by holding raves, and I became a promoter for a while. I think the high point was when we booked Nina Kravitz, no relationship to Lenny Kravitz, but she's a Russian techno DJ. And by this time, I was doing the contracts for her appearance, which includes her riders and stuff. And so then we realized that the takings on the bar were significant. So you could get 1,000 people under the fire regulations into Shoreditch Station. So that's probably 10 grand on the door at any one moment. But, you know, you're holding it with a 12-hour gig. It was from noon to midnight. And then you substantial takings are really over the bar. So, you know, unbelievably, you suddenly started to witness that holding a rave, could pull an income of 50 to 100 grand, which was unbelievable. And you sort of wondered why bother with the architecture. So during that period, so we tried, but that, we ran into a problem, mainly noise. One time we got sort of noise abatement officers turned up and threatened to shut us down. But the really nice thing about that whole, that them, they realised that you can't shut down a rave because it's going to probably cause a riot. So they basically said, just run it out and then make sure you're all out by midnight and leave peacefully. So that was pretty nice of the local authority. And then we realised we had to look for other forms of meanwhile activities, and moved over into Hot Tub Cinema, which was a much quieter sort of social event. That's six or eight people in a inflatable hot tub, paying £35 each. So you can do maths on that. Our drinks are on top, which is mainly Prosecco, and they're sitting in this hot tub watching a film. And there's probably about 20 or 30 tubs, so you can start to do the maths on, you know, you used to get 10 grand on the tubs, plus before alcohol was brought in. And so we ran that for a while. I got some really good press with German television and different European feeds coming in. So I have to say it was kind of exciting.
It was good times. It was good times. Let's talk.
Yeah, demanding.
Yeah, of course. Let's talk about the developments, one in particular in England that I'm sure is part of the story of your focus on the, cost quality, though. And this, you won the International Architecture category at the New Zealand Institute of Architects Awards for a housing block in London. This was Costa Street in Peckham. Mm. Talk us through.
Well, so the running joke is we used to say in the office cost a lot. we after I bought the site, the Daily Mail ran an article about how Britain's, it was labelled as Britain's most expensive shack, had just sold for £1 million. But of course, they sort of failed to miss the point. Obviously, we weren't buying a shack. And the history of the site was that it was bombed by a V-2 flying rocket in 1944, which had wiped out the terraces, hit this last throw of the dice. Whitehall at the time had given out misinformation so that the rockets were deliberately, they sacrificed, unbelievably, I don't know how that worked, on the part of South London called Peckham. the B2s hit there, knocked out the streets, and then after the war, they built post-war fibrous cement housing, which actually had asbestos all through it. And I just managed to buy the last one and an auction, but kind of a bit nervous about this because we'd bought Shoreditch Station, but we had run into significant problems in getting a planning game. So when we did our due diligence on Shoreditch, Tessa Jarl, who was the Ministry of Heritage and Secretary of State at the time, had deemed the station of no great historic value. But of course we bought it, and then of course everything else, everybody kicked out about how beautiful a quaint station was. So sort of realised that, gosh, I've just bought a Britain's most expensive shack, and it's probably going to be listed now because of its sort of anecdotal or historic value in representing post-war temporary architecture. So I immediately applied for a demolition licence. I think the day after the completion went through, hired a Polish demolition crew and had the building down within 7 days. And did the air tests, and we had an empty site. And I also, like a lot of developers do, I was looking at sites which had no planning on them, no planning game, because that's where the uplift in planning value arises. So the site, just had a planning for this sort of low-rise individual house. And I guess, being an architect, we've got some sort of intel on what might get through at the planning consent. Obviously, the intel didn't work so well on Shoreditch Station. But this time around, we went for a more conservative sort of view and just built something which is, in terms of scale, is more or less in keeping with the existing context. Interesting thing, too, which I noticed in London, particularly South London, the site is at the intersection of two communities, one being predominantly European and the other one being, and that tends to be a slightly bourgeois European terrace housing on Costa Street. And then around the corner is West Indian social housing. I'm sorry, West Indian is not, obviously the housing is not, it's West Indian style, the occupants are West Indian. And it was quite interesting during the process of developing that, of realising you're sort of knitting two communities together. And that was something which sort of joyed very much during the sort of periods of construction and meeting the community. And so you sort of feel a kind of emotional connection. Also because we'd set out to build, Catherine, we weren't building to sell, we were building to rent. And it's a total different kind of strategy, which is gaining traction now here. In fact, I'm running a course on build to rent, where the developer stays in the game, and that leads to a different kind of quality of building. If you're building your own house, you're obviously going to, you're going to make sure that you put the plumbing in satisfactory, you're going to make sure it's sort of watertight, and you're going to build it to a certain quality. And so build to rent tends to have a better built outcome, that meant that, I sort of retained the property, and that's sort of where it is today. And I have to admit, three, 4 years later, not one of the tenants has moved out.
It's a really interesting development, and I know this is a key discussion point actually for New Zealand, the fact that you remain as owner. I know you had oversight over the whole project. You stayed involved. You stayed connected. I wonder if we could shift to your motivation now coming back to New Zealand and research into Māori or Indigenous housing projects. You're bringing this experience that you've had for decades now in the UK, and what are you sort of researching here? What are the ideas that you have here? What are you learning from others about what's happening here?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm really privileged to be in and be able to do again sort of research in the field. So one thing which is quite distinctive about what I do is research. It's in the field, and what I mean, it's usually outside the university, working with living real communities. Yeah, so that's so that means they're live projects. The research I'm doing is called 6 W's, the letter W is highly important to my iwi, Ngāti Awa. Māori say kene, we say wene. So the research is called Six W's. It traces a sort of spiraling lineage from whenua, to which is the land, to wau, which is the forests, through to Piketiri, which is factories, through to waihanga, which is fabrication, onto a fifth W, which is whare, and finally landing with the sixth W, which is whānau. So it's basically forest to factory fabricated housing, and that is the, and it's a very acute piece of work that's essentially what I'm interested in. I'm interested in disrupting that supply chain and disrupting it with, so go back to the first W, it's whenua. So I have an understanding from Motiti Island, where I live, of the complexities of land ownership. We have on that island, it's 50% approximately European title, 50% Māori title, but it offers a kind of interesting snapshot if you fly over it and look down, and you'll see that the parts of the island which have agriculture and horticulture on them, which is mainly harvest avocado, are entirely European owned, and those without trees and nothing is actually happening in terms of the land use is Māori title. And that is because the complexities of land ownership, you know, collective ownership has made it decision-making difficult. And so I guess in the W1 space, which relates to whenua, I'm interested in looking for ways which we can agglomerate land interests. And last night I was having a long meeting with my family, and we were looking at my father. My father was just a typical, symptomatic of what many Māori might be experiencing. So it's land interests maybe in 50, 60 different parts of the country. But of course, it's unlikely to really visit them. You know, Motiti is his tūranga waiwai. But so, you know, at one point we have to sort of relinquish our 1 point share holdings in myriad locations around the country and try to accumulate and agglomerate. So that's the that's my interest within, around the whenua. The wau is obviously, you know, 17% of this country, Māori, own just 7% of the land. Yet with the, thanks to the treaty settlements, increasingly, Māori will own exotic forests, up to 50%. I came from Kauro. I went for 6 years inside Tasman pulp and paper, so forestry is sort of in my blood. And I guess I've got having conversations at the moment with in Ngāti Ara, Runanga, and other factions about the capacity for iwi-owned forests to be propelled into engineering timber products, to sort of, so we could repurpose some of those sawmills, which is the third W, Piketere, into CLT. So what is CLT? It's like plywood. You know, plywood is 22 millimetres, CLT is 230 millimetres. It's made up of lamellas, which are planks of wood, which are laid and glued across each other. And that allows, so it's not like sticks building, Catherine, and sticks and studs building. It's that sort of, you know, that's almost something we should have to get rid of. And I think the other politic around timber construction is at the moment we're exporting the majority of our logs to China as and buying them back as processed, lumber. So there's something inherently wrong with that model. So I guess my interest in Māori housing is looking for massive transformational shifts. Also to do with the design, you know, the design of these houses. The projects I'm working on at the moment range from things like what I call ahi kāinga. That's a papa kāinga meets an ahi kā. That's a place where you can return, like Motiti Island, back to your tūranga waiwai, but you probably won't live there. So on Motiti Island, for example, there's two, the demographic is very acute. There's retired people and those aged at preschool. So grandparents are looking after mokopuna because there's no economy there. And often we'll see that. I've seen that through places also up in Taitokoro, that often the hapu are dispersed or, you know, working. And so that sort of housing project looks to use collective ownership and as a sort of a means of doing... so it's a built to rent through a collective hapu ownership. And so you don't actually own it. You're more likely to sort of timeshare it. And I think that's those are the sort of economic models which are sort of interest me at the moment.
It is, and more broadly, the home ownership model. I know you referenced Germany, where I think it's about 50%. It's a big debate here in New Zealand, the tenuousness of the rental tenant, and not only the rents going up, but the security of tenure. Again, is this something where you see room for big change in New Zealand, so that not everyone has to own their own home, but those who do rent have a very different prospect from what they have today?
Yeah, so for the build-to-rent, it wouldn't sound obviously, but there is a massive implication for hapū, because we have a collective title already. And the difficulty is, so the difficulty of having a collective title is raising finance. Yeah? There have been some interesting models. I think Ngāti Whātua have done it on Kupe Street, where they've built Māori housing, but you know, it's an emerging model. I'm looking forward to sort of teaching it here at the university. And, it's a different, as you say, I mean, Germany is the wealthiest of the EU bloc nations, and yet Germans don't put their money into housing. The house is not seen as a commodity. Money goes, into bonds or stocks or even money in businesses or other things. And so we seem that seems to be a particular Anglo-Saxon trait to treat the land and treat the house as a commodity which can be traded. And of course, that's quite a different way of understanding in comparison to Māori land, which there's a sort of spiritual and emotional connection. And that has value too, because it means, particularly in terms of sustainability and climate change, the Māori centric view of the environment is fundamentally different. I mean, look at whare rauku, they were being made out of, sort of natural materials and stuff. So, the Māori world, traditional Māori world, can also tell us something about a better care and kaitiaki of the environment.
Yeah, Mihi Anthony, we could talk for ages and ages. I just want to touch on the one thing that remains a mystery to me, just to finish. This is just delightful. It was when you were back in London and I think a school project or a school development was happening, and your way of ensuring sort of community involvement of this involved Lego bricks. Could you explain what you did?
So after we won the national award for the rooftop nursery, I sort of left the question, like, how could we get the students more actively engaged in design participation? Okay, today it's called co-design, but back then, it was just more or less a form of public participation. So that was the sort of research question you could say for the project. How can we get the children and the parents more actively involved in the design of their school? Now, we'd done some sort of workshops in the past, and, architects are sort of fairly skilled at drawing. That is our sort of primal tool for design. And so that tends to embarrass most parents, and most of them don't even want to draw next to an architect. So I realised we have to forego drawing. We have to forego the principal means of a representation and design tool. The architect is going to throw away the drawing, and we're going to use Lego bricks instead. And that sort of dawning happened one day, just literally driving to the site. It's in Hillingdon. It's Boris Johnson's electorate. And on the way there, I saw the sign saying Legoland. So I went in there. Then I flew over to Billund. Then I realised that Legoland and Lego, they are not the same company. Legoland is a British company owned by Merlin, who basically produce Lego theme parks. Legoland also happened to be Lego's biggest customer. And so suddenly one got quite schooled on how this whole supply chain was working. So I went over to Billund and I said, I want to build a school out of, I want to get a whole lot of bricks. And we realised that why not just designing the school with Lego bricks, because by this time I managed to procure something like 3,000 to 5,000 bricks per student, and then pupils were encouraged to go home and talk with their parents and try to design an idea of a school. And then it sort of dawned, well, why are we just designing the school with Lego? Why don't we try to build it out of Lego? And then so that's when I went over to Billund to try to talk to Lego, and they said no chance. The risk of a child soiling the brick or something and the reputational damage to Lego meant they're out. So we said fine. So we went back to Legoland and just bought all the bricks that about 1.5 million Brits through Legoland, who, of course, being British, being slightly quirky, had a heritage and a lineage of designing outdoor buildings using Lego bricks. And so that's sort of what happened. And then I had to convince the local authority. Lego bricks, highly inflammable, good way to start a barbecue. I had to find an incandescent coating from 3M. Lucky it was the same 3M, which had given us a lifetime supply of paint on the rooftop nursery because we won this national award. And so there's a sort of natural transfer between projects. And then the last thing was just to get it built. And convincing the teachers, there's a lot of risk. It was a Church of England school. One of the classes, so we ran a curriculum called Le Corbusier. That's right. It's Le Corbusier. So Lego meets Le Corbusier. And we're going to, Le Corbusier being a modernist architect, we're going to teach modernist principles of architecture through Lego bricks. One of the classes was called What Does Jesus Look Like? And then, of course, we realized that the kind of curriculum was sort of threatening the principles and the sort of values of the school. And so it was kind of a project about also navigating a creative pathway through different authorities, the local authority, the education authority, Lego. And that was sort of it. And then we built it.
Wonderful, Anthony. So many stories. Thank you. There's wonderful images on the website so people can see some of what you've been up to these 30 years and, of course, what you're turning your attention to now. Thanks very much, Anthony Huerti.